Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, December 21st, 2011. It is now 7:10 p.m. Central Standard Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our freedom, our right, property, our rights, and our freedom. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio. We are having all sorts of problems this evening. I hate to say that if you're calling up on the computer, you most likely won't be able to get in. We're just totally locked out. We are on Blog Talk Radio, and you can still reach us via telephone, and that's 888-773-4496, or direct 646-652-4620. Please do join us this evening, and we do have Andy Sutton on the wire, and let's get this show going. Good evening, Andy. Can you hear me?
Hey, Joe, how are you?
Well, right now I'm a little frustrated. I can hear you. Can you hear me well? I can hear you very well.
I can hear you fine. That was a bad question I asked you. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just, we're just not streaming right now, but we're going to have a program on Blog Talk Radio, so we'll take it from there. Since we've planned it and we're already 10 minutes late, we'll give it a good old try anyway. Ladies and gentlemen, on our program this evening, we have Andy Sutton, economist and chief strategist for Sutton Associates. And this evening, we're going to be talking a little bit about what's going to transpire, what our trends are for 2012, as well as the currency wars that are beefing up. And anything else that you would like, please call in. It's 888-773-4496. Of course, your emails are always welcome to comments@libertytalkradio.com. Andy, where would you like, now that I'm all ruffled, where would you like to start?
Well, I don't know. You laid out some really good topics. I think probably as good a place to start as any would be this situation over in Europe that's going on right now.
Right.
Obviously, this has been going on for several years with this crisis and the debt situation and the bailouts and the banking and all of that kind of thing. Well, today we actually had news come out of Europe that 523 banks took 489 billion euros in three-year European Central Bank loans. And they're going to take that money and they're going to buy Greek, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, Irish bonds with it. They're going to buy junk. So that's the answer. That's what we're going to do. That's how we're going to fix this. We're going to print up 489 billion euros from nothing, and we're going to take those euros and we're going to buy junk bonds in countries that are in so far over their head, it's not even funny, and that's the solution. That's what we're going to do.
Well,
so that's how they're going to kick the can down the road for another couple of years on this. So they're just going to print euros or print dollars or whatever they need to print to make this thing go away. And the only consequence of that, obviously, is it's not going to go away. It's going to cause a lot of inflation. They're already dealing with that in Europe. And our bank is involved, our Fed. They're involved. They're doing lots of swaps. They're swapping dollars for euros to keep that whole thing liquid. So they're creating a lot of inflation here. That's going to translate into higher cost of living for people here. And basically, when you think about it, this whole bailout of Greece, Italy, Spain, the pigs, whatever they want to call them, is going to sit on the shoulders of the U.S. taxpayer by the time this is all over. And that's pretty much the bottom line.
Now, that's the good news, right, Andy? What's the bad news?
That's the good news. It was only 489 billion euros. It could have been a trillion.
That's right. You know, I understand Hungary's bonds got downgraded to junk status today.
Well, this has been going on, too. I mean, that's another whole facet to this situation. You have S&P, Moody's, Fitch. They're basically going at a clip of about one a week, it seems, on these downgrades of sovereign debt. And I sit here and I watch these news articles fly across the wire. You know, Hungary got cut, Spain got cut, Greece got cut three notches, Italy got cut two notches, all the way across the board. And I'm thinking, what about us? How does the United States government maintain even a AA rating? I mean, they made such a big deal when we lost the AAA rating a few months ago. We should be triple F minus with our debt. I mean, we take all of these guys and make them look like, you know, little kids running a lemonade stand on the street corner.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is really, it's the 800-pound gorilla that's hiding in the room that nobody wants to talk about. Because, well, we're the dollar standard, and we've got the world's reserve currency, and if we get a cold, the rest of the world gets the flu. I mean, you've heard all these things.
Right.
But we're in no better shape. I mean, we're in infinitely worse shape than any of these European countries. Infinitely worse. So, I mean, that's something you and I have talked about before. It's well known in, you know, people who read my stuff, people who read, you know, guys like Peter Schiff, Mike Shedlock, and all those. This crowd, we talk about this often, but you don't really hear that much about that, you know, in places like the CBS Evening News or CNN or CNBC or places like that.
Yeah, you know, sort of like, you know, General Salente said once, he said, you know, you always hear people say, you know, it's a good time to buy, you know, buy now, the market's doing well, it's going up, you know, and ride the wave, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then when things are going to pot, they go, this is a great buying opportunity. And he makes a good point. He says, you never hear anyone say, sell and run.
Oh, no, of course not. Well, see, you have to remember, if you're looking at a program on CNBC or Fox or CNN or any of these networks, they live by advertising.
Right.
And on these financial shows, every advertisement is, you know, this mutual fund company, this bank, this credit card. It's all paid for by the people whose best interest it is in for this to continue.
Right.
Now, so if you have Goldman Sachs paying for advertising time on a financial show on CNBC, they're not going to talk on that show about selling Goldman Sachs. They're going to talk about, hey, this is the best time ever to buy. I mean,
right.
You have to understand who's paying for this stuff, because that's really what drives the content of these programs. If you don't put on your program what your sponsors want to hear, they're not going to pay you. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, the one aspect that that frustrates me more than probably all of it, because I understand that everyone's manipulating, and everyone is in this building that's a fire trap. They all know it's a fire trap. Everyone's smoking. Everyone's afraid that someone's going to drop a cigarette. The whole building's going to go up, and everyone's eyes are out the front door, and everyone wants out first, of course. But I understand that. I mean, we live in that environment, and we have for some time now. What really concerns me is that we continually hear how things are getting better. In fact, all the economic indicators, even those that are published, you know, by the government, which the American Institute of Economic Research, which is independent, and they sort of parrot what's on those charts and give an indication of what they mean, indicate that the recovery is incredibly sluggish, but it's creeping along very, very, very slowly, albeit employment and housing is still in the doldrums and not getting much better. How could all of this be getting a little bit better when you hear statistics regarding the number of people who are on food stamps, the number of people who are in poverty or near poverty, the number of people who hardly can make ends meet. I mean, and the list goes on. And all of those are getting worse and worse. None of them are getting any better. You hear 44 million, 44.55, 45 million. I mean, it just creeps up. I mean, it gets to the point where no one's going to be working. Everyone's going to be getting some sort of assistance or starving to death. But everything's going to be fine. And I don't understand that. Could you shed some light on that for me, please?
Well, sure. I mean, really what you've got here is you have this huge divergence in a lot of these different reporting metrics as far as macroeconomic data goes. And I wrote a piece back on the 1st of December, and it talked about three particular reports, the ADP employment change Chicago Purchasing Managers Index and the pending home sales number. And you were talking about three, I mean, they're fairly important series, especially the Chicago PMI, you know, as far as gauging business sentiment. And these reports that came out, the actual result that was reported by the government was either four or five standard deviations outside what the mean forecast was. And these forecasts are made by professional economists. Four and five standard deviations outside of what the forecasts were. I mean, that's unheard of.
What do you mean by a four or five standard deviation? For the sake of our listeners.
Basically, what you're talking about is if you're looking at a bell curve, you're talking about that really, really skinny part at either end.
Right.
Like the skinniest, skinniest part. You're talking about black swans. I mean, I think people are probably familiar with that term. You're talking about events that are very, very unlikely as far as, you know, actually taking place. And we had three of them within a week on these three major reports. So, I mean, what that tells me is that there's a lot of fudging going on right now. You know, and this is something that I've spent a lot of time on, especially with retail sales, GDP, you know, and those types of metrics. And we don't need to go into that because we've been there before. But, you know, this is going on across the board on a lot of these statistics where it's really kind of the perception of the reality. So if we say that the Chicago PMI is looking good, that's going to somehow cajole people into separating with dollars at the business level. But then you go ahead and you run that down to Main Street, you look at personal incomes, you look at credit burden, you look at foreclosures, you look at home vacancies, you look at all these other series, and all of a sudden you're talking about a totally different picture.
Right.
And I think one big one that's being missed, and this is something I made in my notes here and I circled to talk about tonight, is velocity of circulation of money.
Right.
And basically that is an indicator of how fast dollars are moving through the system.
Right.
And the higher the number, the better.
Right.
The lower the number, the worse.
Right.
I focus in on M2, velocity of circulation, which is basically all your cash, checkable bank deposits, and then bunch of different flavors of time deposits like CDs and things like that. You know, we don't need to go into the specific criteria, but it's basically the part of the money supply that tends to move around a lot in the economy.
Right.
And we've been seeing that take an absolute dive since the year 2000. It kind of recovered from 2004 through about 2008, and then it just fell off a cliff into 2009. It kind of tried to make a rebound in 2010, and guess what? It's tanking again. And that basically what that means is that you have fewer transactions in the economy. That's not healthy. That does not jive with what they're talking about on a lot of these shows. We're saying, oh, well, the recovery is very sluggish. I'm not seeing a recovery at all from where I'm sitting.
Right.
You know, and you and I have talked about, you know, the erroneous GDP figures that they use, because they put government borrowed spending right into it.
Right.
So the government borrows $1.5 trillion. That's about what the size of the deficit is. They borrow $1.5 trillion and they spend it, and we're supposed to count that as economic growth.
Right.
And nobody bothers to sit and figure out, hey, you know, that money was borrowed. At some point, that transaction gets reversed. It needs to be paid back.
Yeah, and that actually is a negative. I mean, from the Austrian School of Economics,
well, sure it is.
That should be subtracted and not added, if anything else, to be
exactly,
more accurate.
Exactly, right. Exactly. At the very least, it shouldn't be counted at all.
Right, I
so
agree.
So what I did in-house here is I used something called the Cobb-Douglas production function, which is it's basically an algebraic formula that uses capital, labor, and multi-factor productivity. And what that does is it kind of takes some of this out. I mean, obviously, you know, the government borrows money. They spend it on highway projects. Yeah, that's going to add up man hours for labor. So it doesn't totally get rid of it, but it's a lot more honest than what we have now, what's being reported by the Commerce Department. And what I've seen in that is we went into recession back at the end of 2006, and we never came out.
Right, right.
That's what that's showing. And this M2 velocity of circulation totally agrees with that. And when you use my number instead of the Commerce Department's number, M2 velocity of circulation looks even worse. So, you know, that totally flies in the face of all this. Well, you know, there's really no jobs and there's really no there's no housing market and consumer prices are still going up and it's getting more and more expensive to do pretty much everything. But hey, everything's going to be great. It's getting better, and, you know, we don't really have anything to worry about. We got a lot to worry about.
Well, even the new housing numbers, the readjusted housing numbers, showed that the number of houses sold were substantially inflated, and when they redid the numbers, they were much lower. Well, they were low to start off with, even with the inflated numbers, and those new numbers came out and showed that we're even in worse shape than we were before. And so here we sit with a situation that's worse than it was, and it was not good to start off with. We have a caller on the air, and I do believe that's our friend Jim. You want to take Jim's question?
Yeah, sure. He's early tonight.
Yeah, he sure is. Well, good for him.
Early bird gets the worm.
Hey, Jim, is that you?
Yes, it is. Joe, Andy, good evening, guys.
Yeah, Jim,
how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Jim, we lost part of our connection. We're on Blog Talk Radio. We have our lines, but we, for some reason, I keep on getting disconnected on the streaming part of the program. I just wanted you to know that. But we are alive and screaming, and alive and broadcasting anyway, but on Blog Talk Radio only, it appears at this point.
Yeah, I got you on Blog Talk Radio, and I see you started about 10 after tonight, didn't you?
That is correct, right, because we just couldn't get it cranked up. We kept on, you know, rewinding it. It wouldn't work.
Yeah, I was. And anyway, so here I am live. Good, Andy. Always good to hear you on the show. I had one kind of basic economics question, and then one follow-up question. My broker has mentioned about this Baltic Dry Index. Can you briefly explain to me in layman's terms what that is and what significance it has or doesn't have in looking at the global economy?
Basically, what the Baltic Dry Index is, it's a shipping index of dry goods, and they keep track of how many cargo ships of particular goods go through different points up there in that part of the world. And the idea is the higher it is, obviously, the better. The lower it is would indicate that there's recessionary forces in play. Trying to think off the top of my head what a good analog of that would be in this country, and I'm not coming up with anything right now, but that's basically what that is. It's a measurement of consumer spending, consumption, those types of things.
Okay, so it is in a general sense related to economic output growth.
It's very relevant. I mean, it's definitely worth following for sure.
Okay. He's mentioned it a couple times, and I just hadn't become that familiar with it, or used that as a basis of determining the economic activity. Really a non-economic question, but one that I think myself and all of us and all the listeners would be interested in. In light of the collapse of MF Global and that debacle, where many individual investors lost every penny, including, you know, the Solentes is probably most known for losing six figures in gold futures. And so my question is how can one determine if their brokerage firm or bank is truly a safe and secure place to put your money, and how would you determine that, and what measures of security would you suggest someone that had a six or seven figure investments to try to secure?
I mean, basically what you're looking, and it's a very good question, by the way. This is not the first time I've heard this, and it's very good. Essentially, what happened, you know, just to kind of recap the MF Global thing, is there's two sides. I mean, they're a broker-dealer, so there's two sides to their business. Basically, they have the retail side, which deals with regular customers, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, what have you, that whole side. And then there's the dealer side, which is kind of the inside of the whole operation, which they do their own thing. They take on investment positions. They can take risk. They will use leverage to try to, you know, achieve whatever goals or benchmarks that they're trying to achieve. Well, the problem is that inside, that dealer side, in this case, made huge bets, and some of those bets were with clients. So they had kind of, you know, a crossing of the Rubicon there between the dealer and the broker side, and they got burned, and the whole thing went up. Now, the kicker is that doesn't explain why people lost their money.
Right.
you know, not, that money just didn't disappear. Now, you know as well as I do, if you make an error on a check or on a bank deposit slip, whatever, it's caught very quickly, and it could be just a couple of cents, but it's usually caught the same day, if not the same day, the next day. We live in the age of computers. You can click a mouse and buy junk bonds from Greece if you wanted to, pretty much around the clock.
Right.
There is no plausible reason why that money couldn't have been found within 5 minutes.
So, yeah, so you're not buying Corzine's explanation that what do they call it, the Sergeant Schultz explanation. I know nothing. I don't know what happened to it.
Right, yeah. We didn't intend to break any rules. No, that's baloney.
Right.
That's baloney. Money can be traced very quickly. I know that as an investment advisor. If somebody suspects that one of my clients is involved in some kind of illegal activity, that money can be tracked down and fingered within minutes.
Yeah.
And there's absolutely no reason to believe that this money couldn't have been tracked down. Sure, the dealer side got burned. That money was lost, but that's not the client's money. That money for client accounts in that type of a situation is in segregated accounts. That means it's held separately. It is not to be commingled with dealer money. Now, whether they did that, whether they commingled it, or you know, whether something else was going on, we don't really know yet, and we probably will never know, to be honest with you. I mean, Corzine was a Goldman Sachs boy.
Exactly.
So
if anybody
knows how to rob a bank, it's a Goldman Sachs boy, and I'm just being honest.
Oh, yeah, and he donates hundreds of thousands of dollars to all the campaigns and all the political parties.
He knows how to play the game.
Yeah, and they just threw softball questions at him. He needed to be indicted and been thrown.
He should have been let out of there in handcuffs.
Exactly. So,
you know, let's throw him down in the D.C. Central Jail there, and I bet you we'd have some answers within an hour or two.
Exactly. So again, as much as this debacle exposes the corruption and cronyism and criminality that goes on, as an investor, how do I know if my brokerage account at a regional brokerage firm or ABC Bank, you know, is there anything you can do to feel secure and to do your due diligence and make sure your money's can't get ripped off like an MF Global?
Absolutely. What you need to do is you need to talk to your broker and you need to force them to make disclosures, and you need to find out how big their dealer side of the operation is, what percentage of their transactions on the dealer side are involving customers. See, futures are kind of unique because if you're talking about, like, say you're with, Vanilla E-Trade or TD Ameritrade or Scottrade or somebody like that, most of their transactions between the dealer side and the retail side are once and done. You know, you buy 100 shares of stock, the dealer sells it to you, the transaction's over. It doesn't remain open. But when you start talking about options and futures contracts that have expiration dates at some point certain in the future, now all of a sudden you're talking about, well, those transactions, they stay open. They're ongoing.
Yeah.
So you want to find out from your broker-dealer what percentage of your business is that type of activity. You know, is this a large portion of your activity? Is it a small portion of your activity? You want to find out how much leverage they've deployed on their dealer side.
Okay.
You know, are you 20-1? Are you 50-1? You know, what's the deal? You also want to find out what their exposure to various kinds of debt is. You want to find out, hey, do you have exposure to Eurozone debt? Do you have exposure to, you know, junk-rated mortgage-backed securities? Because if that's the case, then you take whatever they're telling you their leverage ratio is and you double it.
I understand. Okay. It's the whole
FASB Rule 157 mark-to-model accounting rule change back from 2009. If you remember that one.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the suggestions. I'll probe a little further, or be just like Joe and just be your own central banker.
Yeah. There you go.
Hey, Jim, let me ask you this.
Listen, I'm going to listen to the rest of the show, but I'll let you go. And you have a great holiday season, Andy. I always enjoy you on Joe's broadcast.
Jim, before you hang.
Thank you, sir. You have a Merry Christmas.
Jim, before you let go.
Yeah.
Jim.
Generally,
how do you feel about investing today? And from your perspective, where should people be investing in, just from your perspective?
Oh, I'll just say I'm becoming more and more convinced that it's a rigged casino, that it's, you know, the volatility, and that all of the hedge funds and the Congress people that have inside knowledge, you know, have such a leg up on the average retail investor. In some respects, my portfolio is in a position that I can sleep at night and can handle the volatility. But I've also never been more than one third in a cash position like I am today. And you know how much I hate the U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
So the fact that I'm even fearing an additional pullback in precious metals, which is, you know, in my eyes the safest place to be.
Yeah.
But I don't want to, you know, buy gold at 1700 and have it drop to 1200 in a couple weeks. So.
Right.
I'm holding tight in a cash position, still like commodities, precious metals, and commodities. There's a handful of other things you can do to get decent 5 to 10% yields, but it's a dicey market out there.
Right.
And I'm getting, you know, from all the different advisors I listen to, and Andy and Joe, I know you read a lot of different investment advisories. It seems like there's a definite split between people that are bullish and think that the market's going to do well despite the economy, that stocks are undervalued and that earnings are good, and then there's other people that are doom and gloom and fearing a crash worse than 2008.
Yeah,
I've never seen such a disparity, such a division of opinions as to what the market has in store for us.
It must be difficult for the casual observer or the casual investor. He must be going bananas at this point, not knowing what to do, and feeling no matter what he does do or she does do, it's going to be wrong.
Yeah. Andy, do you have any, from, you know, you read and study a lot of investment advice, so you don't have to tell us specifically your own recommendation, but do you agree there's a lot of mixed opinions, and what's your take as to what's going on in the market?
No, it seems to me like people are either on one side or the other.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of people in the middle right now, and you've got a lot of people that are pointing at earnings and P/E ratios and all of this kind of thing and saying, hey, you know, there's no reason we couldn't have Dow 15 or 20,000. And I'm sitting there and saying, yeah, okay, let's take a look at the level of corporate indebtedness. Somebody who is a bull on stocks needs to really go to, you know, one of the, you know, EconoMagic or one of these other websites that generates macro charts, and take a look at corporate indebtedness and see what story that tells. And then ask yourself where those earnings are really coming from.
Exactly. And also, stocks are based upon future and projected earnings. And if we were to fall into a deep economic crisis, all those forecasts, you can, you know, throw them out the window.
Oh, absolutely, sure.
So I'm a little skittish. Like I said, I'm in a stronger cash position than ever before, but I don't like it because it could be, you know, tomorrow we could have a currency collapse. So so I'm befuddled by the whole thing and just try to, you know, cope with it as best I can. But thanks for asking, Jeff.
Okay, and Jim, thank you very much for calling in. Appreciate your dedication to Liberty Talk Radio. All right.
You bet. Love talking to both of you guys. Good evening.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, Jim.
You bet. Bye, Andy.
Well, I'm not certain if it was in your newsletter, Andy, but people keep on talking about the plethora of cash that corporations have, but if you look at the balance sheet, they have they have cash on the balance sheet only because their debt now is about three times higher than it normally is. And if you look at the cash ratio, the quick ratio of companies, it's very poor. I'm not sure if I read that in your newsletter or someone else's newsletter, but they made that because people say, oh, the companies have so much money, they're not letting it go. Well, they do have a lot of money sitting there, but they have exponentially more debt than normal, and they can't let it go because if they did, they'd lose their own ability to borrow or to get credit.
Well, I'm going to give you some rough numbers here. Non-financial corporate businesses, I just pulled up the chart on EconoMagic to contribute to this discussion. Since 2007 is up by 33%. So So that's corporate indebtedness. Not, that's the non-financials. That's the non-banks.
Right.
So that's your DuPonts, your IBMs,
right,
your, well, not General Motors really anymore, but that those kind of companies. So this is a big problem, obviously, is indebtedness. And that is something that you don't really hear talked about. And this is, again, it comes back to the Keynesian point of view where the debt really doesn't matter. You know, oh, well, the U.S. owes $15 trillion. Well, actually, it's a lot worse than that when you start to look at past the federal government. You start to look at all the different levels. You know, you throw in consumer debt, you throw in student loans, you throw in mortgages,
right,
you throw in corporate indebtedness, you throw in bank leverage, you throw in the whole enchilada. You're talking about right now, present-day dollars. You want to take a guess what the number is?
No idea.
$58.5 trillion. And that's not including unfunded liabilities. That
right
is actual stated accrued debt owed right now across the whole enchilada.
Well, Andy, what is holding all of this up? I'm such a conservative person. Every morning I get up, the first thing I do is I pay a bunch of bills because I have two companies. And all I do, I'm always paying bills, always making sure that I have enough money in the bank, pay the bills, everything is paid for, I have enough working capital. You know, I'm always putting the brakes on everything. Anytime anything goes out of what I consider my, you know, the parameters that I need to operate. And I'm so conservative. Well, I've survived that way, which is, I guess, good in a way, but it drives you nuts after a while. And yet, outside of my world, it seems like, you know, bing, nothing counts anymore. It doesn't make any difference.
You don't know what's holding this together?
No idea.
It's really simple. You like Starbucks, don't you?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. You walk into Starbucks. What's your favorite item there? What do you get? Large coffee, espresso, whatever?
Yeah, I just get, yeah, sometimes espresso and sometimes just the regular, you know, the coffee of the day, you know, whatever it happens to be.
All right. How do you pay for it?
Oh, I pay cash.
Okay. What do you use?
Cash.
Okay. It gets you something, right?
Yeah.
That's what's holding this together.
Ah.
People know. Yeah. I mean, they know the value of their dollars are going down. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
I think pretty much you'd have to kick over some pretty big rocks to find people who don't understand that.
Right.
But the bottom line is you can go into a Starbucks or a grocery store or a gas station or whatever the case may be, and you can take that paper out of your pocket and you can hand it to them, and they'll give you something real for it.
Okay. Well, you know,
that confidence, that perception, that's the only thing
all right
that holds together a fiat monetary system,
okay,
like the one that we have. And the same goes for the guys over in Europe and pretty much around the whole globe, because we don't have anything else but that really anymore. It's paper. It can be printed from basically nothing at essentially no cost, and the value is destroyed on a regular basis. I mean, you take a look at a dollar in 1913 is worth 4 cents and change today. They've destroyed 96% of its value,
right,
in 100 years. But it still has value, and that is what keeps the system glued together.
Well,
and that's the bottom line, that confidence. And, you know, people don't even think about it. They just go in, they pull out the dollar bill, they get the cup of coffee. It's almost like it's subconscious.
Well, are many
that's what
people
holds it together.
Are many people paying with dollars, or are most people still paying with the credit card, which is even worse?
Well, I mean, really, at the end of the day, it's still dollars.
Yeah. Okay. I agree. Yeah.
You know, they pay the credit card bill in, you know, with a check that comes from a bank, which holds dollars. I mean, it all
right
trickles back to the idea that you can take these tickets, these green paper tickets, and you can exchange them for something that actually has real value, when the paper ticket itself is worth nothing. When you think about it, what's that piece of paper worth? I mean, what is the difference between a Federal Reserve note, $1 note, and that little piece of paper in the Monopoly game? I mean, really, it's a piece of paper. It's got ink on it. It's got a little picture. What's really the difference? The perception and the confidence that it actually buys something.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, our dollar is not backed by gold. It's not backed by buffalo chicks. I mean, it's not backed by anything.
Right. Well, you know,
it's backed by, well, the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, which is in debt 100 times over, more than it ought to be.
Yeah.
So really, what is it backed by?
Well, you know,
confidence. That's it.
Yeah. I guess confidence, and that's what General Sunday calls a con game that we're in. Well, you know, my mother, my wife,
yeah,
just,
pretty much.
My wife just had a unfortunately a root canal, and boy, it was a lot more expensive than she had anticipated. And her secretary in her prior office also had dental work done, and her comment was, "Geez, it was a lot more expensive than last time," and I think. Everything. And my wife says, well, I think this was over $100 more than I had anticipated. And her secretary said the same thing. They said it was over $100 more than she anticipated. And I think all these things are starting to add up. Everything. I received my water sewer bill, you know, refuge bill today. And normally it's like $45, $50. It was $62. Could not figure out why. There was no extra charges on it, but every single item went up. $62 for the month. You know, for refuge service, you know, sewerage and water. And I don't use any water. I mean, I don't water my lawn or anything. I just, my wife and I, we drink a glass of water once in a while. This has got to be eroding people's ability to buy and eventually erode their confidence in this whole currency game.
But you know what? I'm going to tell you something. Many economists have died an early intellectual death by calling an end to this age of consumerism, materialism, whatever you want to call it. I was almost at the point back in 2010 when people started to retrench a little bit. Remember we talked about the consumer credit numbers started to go down, and that's what caused the deflation, by the way, was that people actually started to pay off debt instead of accumulating more. I was almost at the point where I was going to say, yep, this is it. And I'm like, you know what? Don't do it.
Right.
Don't do it because you've been surprised before, and they'll do it again. And sure enough, they're back at it. And all the reports from Black Friday and the first couple weeks of, you know, the shopping season here for the holidays, and the numbers have been very good. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, personal incomes are down. Property values are doing basically zip, or they're still going down. Where's all this money coming from? Now, we won't see consumer credit numbers for December until February, unfortunately. But I'm willing to bet a lot of this shopping is being swiped.
Oh, yeah. Now, I also heard an interesting a comment that said that returns were at an all-time high. I don't know what those numbers were, but someone had made the comment on one of the financial networks.
Interesting.
That said returns were at all-time high, unexpectedly high. Yeah. And that's it.
But, buyer's remorse?
Well, you know, there are those people who continually will respond by saying, oh, yeah, prices are going up, but they've always gone up. But then wages eventually will adjust. And he says, so we're always in the same place, so no need to worry. Well,
that's a losing battle,
yeah,
right there.
There is. Could you talk to that? If I told you that, I mean, if someone told you that and said, well, you know, so the price of bread goes up 20 cents, but at the end of the year I get a 5% increase in pay, and it sort of covers everything. So, you know, everything's more expensive, but everything is still equal. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's a real simple one. If you go back to the 1950s and you look at the average family back in the 1950s, basically you had a single breadwinner, dad, or, you know, sometimes mom, whatever the case was. You had, most households were single breadwinner. And you had a family home, you had one car, the picket fence, you know, Ward Cleaver, the whole nine yards there.
Yeah.
And it was done basically with very little debt. Usually a note on the home, and that was generally it. I mean, credit cards did not exist back in the 1950s. You couldn't even buy stuff on a store, store credit for the most part, unless you were a business. You know, the average person didn't really have any type of consumer credit. Well, you saw we went into the 60s and the 70s, and all of a sudden now, instead of having one breadwinner, families needed to have two or, you know, one and a half. You know,
right.
Whoever wasn't working needed to take on a part-time job to make ends meet. And they blamed it, well, that was the Arabs' fault in 73 and 74, and then again in 78 with the embargoes and the oil and all this other kind of stuff and whatever. And then you went to the 80s, and it continued, and you pretty much got most families into the two breadwinner category in the 80s. And that's about the time when you started to see store credit cards come out the early to mid-1980s. You could get a Sears card. You could get a JCPenney card. Whatever was good in that store only, you could buy stuff on time, and you paid interest and all that kind of stuff. And people started doing a little bit of that. And then you got into the 90s, and just the and then you had that's when you had Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, all these companies started coming into the forefront, and consumer credit just took off. If you take a look at that chart, it was like 1992, 1993, that time period, that chart just went parabolic. And consumers just started to just take on all kinds of debt. And keep in mind, you still had two breadwinners. It wasn't like we said, all right, you know, we're going to go back to one breadwinner and we're just going to do it with debt now. No, it was two people working and now all this credit card debt. And that was kind of the theme for the 90s. And then you got to the early part of the 21st century and it became home equity. That was the next engine of spending really was cash out refinances, adjustable rate mortgages, option arms, reverse amortization loans, all of these types of things. Anything, Joe, to get money in the pockets of consumers so they would go and spend. That has been the drive of banks, policymakers, government politicians, really for the last 40, 45 years, has been to keep people spending money. Obviously, you can't put two people and then another third into the workforce, so we had to come up with another way. So we got people used to paying on time. We got people used to taking on debt and just making monthly payments. And now it's pretty much in a situation now, for the most part, where you have the vast majority of Americans making payments, and they're used to it, and some of them mind it. I work with a lot of people that really are bothered by this, and they're working their tails off to get out from under, and it's admirable. And I encourage people to do that if you possibly can. But there's so many other people, Joe, they don't care.
Right.
They've kind of adopted that Keynesian standpoint where, you know, it doesn't matter if I make $100,000 a year and spend $250,000.
Right.
It doesn't matter because the debt doesn't matter. And they see their government doing this, enacting this way, and then people figure, well, if they can do it, so can I.
Yeah.
And maybe it was the other way around. I don't know. Maybe the government saw the people doing it and said, hey, if they don't mind it, they're certainly not going to mind it if we do it too. I mean, I don't know what came first there. But that's really how that has happened. Now, to address what you said, would have that all been necessary if the dollar had maintained its value? Right. The answer is no.
Yeah.
If the dollar had maintained its value, you wouldn't have to do all this stuff. Inflation, monetary inflation, borrowed money, printed money, all of that is the cause for pretty much everything that's happened with regards to, you know, people having two and three jobs, people being in debt up to their eyeballs. I mean, yeah, you know what? People signed on the bottom line. They wanted all these things. I get that. But when you're talking about basic expenses, you look at the cost of a gallon of gas now versus 20 years ago. Has that on a percentage basis kept up with people's wages? Not even close.
Right.
And you look at health care. Has that kept up? Not even close. You look at college education. Has that kept up? Not even close. I mean, college education inflates at 7, 7.5, 8% a year.
Yeah.
Nobody, very few people get that kind of a raise.
Right.
I mean, it's just these costs have just far outstripped the ability of people to switch jobs or generate raises. And over time, in the aggregate, what you end up having happen is people fall behind.
Right.
And they've used credit to supplement that. And now you're in a situation, really, where you have people using credit cards to buy groceries, to buy gasoline, just basic staple stuff, and they're not able to pay it off at the end of the month. And they're making payments on their food.
Right.
I mean, that's where we're at.
You know, I remember when credit cards first came out. The first one that I saw was called a Unicard, and this was back in the 1960s. And what was really interesting is that when they first came out, they said, well, I have a credit card now, but I only use it for major purchases or, you know, whatever. But I would never use it for gasoline or food or anything like that. That was unheard of back then. I mean, you wouldn't dare take a credit card out, you know, and buy spinach with it, you know, or milk. You know, you would. It would only be used for, and that crept. It kept on creeping down. It seems like all of what you're saying is all of this has been a means in which people have been depleting their net worth. And one figure that I have never seen is. We see, you know, the amount of money people are putting in their 401k plans and things like that. But I've never seen an attempt, and maybe it's impossible, of measuring people's net worth today compared to the net worth of the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, for example. But because from time to time when I go to a coin store, because I give a silver coin to every one of my employees at the end of the month, and that comes out of my own pocket because I feel strongly that anyone who is broke is a poor employee. And I always want my employees to feel as if they have some wealth. It's very important to me, and I think it's very important to them. And it's worked because I haven't had turnover in 8 years or something like that. And I really think that they don't say anything, but I know they appreciate it. Right? But when I go there and I sit there, and they'll be – this is a large place. It's like the place that you see on porn stars, you know, counters all over the place, and you'll see a line of people, and in front of each of the people, each person, there's a little mound, you know, of jewelry. Now you know they're not buying it; they're selling it, and I keep on asking, I say, what are people doing? And the answer, and I'll wrap it up in a few words, is they're selling the last vestiges of their net worth, and that's sad.
Yeah, well, absolutely. They're selling the family jewels.
That's right.
I live out in Podunk, basically, you know, by your standards. Small town. We have a little mall here. There's a cash for gold place in that mall around this time of year, from Thanksgiving to after Christmas. There's a cash for gold place.
And I bet
people
you
go up there with their little pile. They sell off the family jewels, and they get the money, and they take it, and they spend it on whatever.
That is
going on.
And it's interesting because I always ask one of the gentlemen behind the counter, and I just try to see what the answer would be, and they say, oh yeah, there's several people, you know, selling like this, and he says, I guess they have to pay their rent this month, and they joke about it. They have to pay their rent. I said, is anyone buying? They said, oh yeah, you know, several people come in, and they sell whatever they have, and then one person would come in and buy a heck of a lot, you know, buy, you know, a few, you know, several ounces, you know, a couple pounds of silver or gold or whatever, and that person walks out. And it seems like there's going to be, the gap is getting larger and larger. There are going to be a few people who are saving, you know, or investing their money in something like that, in precious metals, and there are those who are selling everything that they can to pay the rent. So that gap is getting wider and wider. Is that a perception or is that, you think, reality?
No, I think it's a reality. I mean, and we can add some evidence to that. You mentioned it at the outset of the show when you talk about the number of people that are receiving food stamps. You talk about the number of people that are on LIHEAP assistance, energy assistance, and Medicaid, all these other types of social support programs. I mean, they're bursting at the seams with subscribers at this point. And, yeah, I mean, you read articles where they're, you know, it's fraud here, fraud there. This person signed up and they're really making $100,000 a year. But I'm pretty convinced that the vast majority of those people are people that are in dire straits and they really need it. And, you know, that's the interesting thing about, you know, you take this velocity of circulation thing we talked about before and kick that around a little bit, and you start to come to a conclusion that basically you have two big groups. You have a group at the top that are hoarding money, basically. They have the large time deposits. And if you look at the components of M2, you can see this bear out totally. You have a huge group at the top, maybe 8%, 9% of the population, and they've got the lion's share of the cash. And they're basically hoarding it and sitting on it. And then you have another big group all the way down at the bottom that are scurrying around and spending it like crazy. There's not a lot happening in the middle.
Yeah.
So in the aggregate, you know, in totality, what you end up having happen is circulation is going down because you really have probably between 2/3 and 3/4 of the people really aren't doing an awful lot.
Right.
they're just kind of sitting on their hands. You know, Jim was on before here, and he was talking about his investment strategy. You know, he's basically sitting on his hands right now.
Right.
Now, he's an investor,
right.
But I think you have a lot of consumers that are doing that too.
Right.
They're taking that same approach. They're sitting on their hands. They're not sure about their job. They don't have a lot of savings. And they're just kind of waiting to see what happens. And the sales aren't good enough to really get them out. And they really shouldn't be spending the money anyway. And some of them probably do. And then they get buyer's remorse, and they turn around and they take the stuff back. Mm-hmm. You know, and that piece you brought out, I mean, that's really, when you start trying to squeeze these puzzle pieces together and see how this whole picture is shaping up, we really are coming to a situation where we've got a tale of two cities in this country right now. We've got a lot of have-nots, we have a few haves, and then we've got a lot of people who are in the middle, and they don't know what they have and what they don't have.
Right. Well, you know, people say, we've been through...
That's the way I'm seeing it.
We've been through this before, we'll get through it again. And you know, I don't argue with anyone because it's meaningless, but my mental response is, no, we have not been through this before.
No, you know, we definitely
have. We have not. I mean, it's like...
No, this is all new. I mean, you know, people as well, the recession, okay, yeah, we've been through recessions before. We've been through some pretty bad ones. You go back in the 70s, the early 80s, we had back-to-back, double dip. You go back to... You know, obviously the late 1920s, 1930s, I mean, that was a lost decade there. You can go back another 100 years and find periods of depression caused by bank runs, bank panics, defaults, the whole nine yards. But what you didn't have then that you have now, and this is the big difference, and it always, you know, and I sound like a broken record, it's the debt. And that is the big difference between, you know, the 2008 period, the 2011 period, and the 2000-2001 period, the 1991-1992 period, the 1981-82-83 period. It's the debt, and
right.
It's systemic. It's at all levels. It's huge. I mean, you're basically looking at a situation right now with that $58.4 trillion or whatever it is. It's right around there, 58 and change. If you were to essentially have us become a flying gas can, economically speaking, and no discretionary spending at all by anybody, it would take at least a half dozen years to clear that, at least.
Yeah. Wow. All right, let's just stop. Let's
and that's station. Basically everybody buying ramen noodles and eating those up and going to work and coming home and not doing much of anything else.
Right. Now, hold on a second. Let me see if we can try station identification, see if this works.
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio.
Well, that's working.
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Political talk derived from a historical perspective, not always palatable, but good food for thought.
Okay.
Pure libertarian talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.